Welcome to Stand to Reason Radio. I'm your guest host today, Sean McDowell, filling in for Greg Kokel, who is getting some much-needed rest and relaxation. Well, last hour we took some questions, interacted, and had a wonderful time. This hour, I get to interview a good friend of mine, a special guest who will be certainly recognizable to the Stand to Reason Radio. And in fact, I'm going to bring him in right now and introduce him. Scott, are you there, buddy?
I am.
Awesome. Thanks for...
Good afternoon.
Oh, yeah. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming in. I was just, in case you didn't hear, introducing you to our guest. Now, I know they know who you are, and that's no secret, but Scott Ray is a bioethicist. He is senior advisor to the president at Biola University, dean of faculty at Talbot, and teaches philosophy and Christian ethics, and I would say is one of the leading Christian ethicists today. Good friend of mine, good friend of Greg's and the Stand to Reason team, and the author of a book we're going to talk about today called Moral Choices, which is in its fourth edition. Before we get into that, Scott, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Sean, good to be with you. Looking forward to the conversation, as always.
Well, this is fun.
It should be fun.
Oh, what I enjoy about this is that you and I host the Biola University Think Biblically podcast together, and usually we're tag-teaming on somebody else. But now I get to kind of pile on you a little bit. No, of course, I'm kidding. I'll be gracious, especially since you're my boss. But
I'm fully prepared for you to beat on me unmercifully here.
So. Oh, good. Of course, we won't do that. We want to get to your book and really highlight and commend it to our audience in case they have not picked it up. But I really consider your book, Moral Choices, An Introduction to Ethics, which is with Zondervan Press. I really consider it the go-to introductory text on ethical issues. So we're going to get into that. But, you know, Scott, one question I want to ask you that we have not really gone through on air is, what is your personal journey to faith? Did you grow up in a Christian home? What was that like where you just owned your own faith and said, I'm a Christian?
Well, to say I grew up in a Christian home, Sean, I think would be a bit of a stretch. My folks were from sort of diehard Presbyterians from the Midwest, and I grew up in Texas. And I think I was one of the few. We were one of the few families who you know, put down roots in Texas and did not become Southern Baptist.
Mm.
My folks actually did attend a Southern Baptist church, but that. You know, later on, but that's kind of a long story. So we grew up in a what I would call a fairly liberal, mainline denominational Presbyterian church, and I actually never heard the gospel until I was about 15.
Wow!
When I started going to this thing at my high school called Young Life.
Yes.
And you know, I went to high school back when you know the Jesus movement was kind of just getting rolling. Young Life was huge in high school throughout Texas, and part of the reason is because the youth ministries and so many of the churches were so totally out of touch with where high school students were. And Young Life was fun, it was relevant, it was where all my friends were involved, but I also really clearly heard the gospel. And I responded to that when I was 16. A good friend that I played hoops with actually led me to the Lord.
Wow.
And then, you know, over the next couple of years, just started to, you know, started to study the scripture. And, you know, I just had a hunger to grow and learn. It was like I'd found this new thing that just was so interesting and awesome and life-changing. And I couldn't get enough of it. And then when I got to college, I had a couple of guys who were their 4 years at Dallas Seminary corresponded with my 4 years of college. And they basically led a Young Life group for college students, which was nothing like what it was in high school. It was a really serious disciple-making group. And these two guys just poured their life into me.
Wow.
And it turned out there were about half a dozen of us that they just spent a ton of time with. All of us ended up going to Dallas Seminary, and all of us are, you know, are earning a living, you know, doing something either in local church ministry or in teaching ministry or in missions or something like that in other parts of the world. So, you know, had it not been for those guys who really, they just poured their life into me. That's where I really kind of sunk deep roots in, and this thing that I had, you know, that I'd experienced in high school had rationality to it. I could actually explain it to people. I remember trying to explain what had happened to me to my best friend shortly after I came to faith, and I didn't have any clue how to articulate my faith or to explain it to him. And he just, I mean, he thought I had just lost my mind. And, you know, and I think to, you know, to any average observer, you know, that probably was pretty accurate. Cause I just, you know, I had had this conversion moment. But it took a while before I had I just didn't have the language to be able to explain it to people.
So for you, your experience with the Lord and understanding the gospel came before philosophy, theology, and ethics. That came afterwards and clarified and solidified your faith. But really, it was just learning about Jesus that drew you to the faith. Is that accurate?
Right. That's right. It was It was the community of believers that was in my young life community that their lives were so compelling. That I said, this is something I want for myself. Really getting grounded well enough to even know what the questions were, much less answer them, sort of came once I got to college and after that.
That's important for apologists to remember that it's both proclaiming truth. Some people like our friend J. Warner Wallace just examined truth before he was in the community or knew what it meant. But then there's an awful lot of people, probably most people, just drawn by the gospel and the love of Christians. Now, for you, why did you choose to go the route of studying ethics professionally? What was it about that that drew you to that field?
Well, you know, I started out, I ended up deciding after I graduated from college, my dad had his own business, and I think the expectation on both of our parts was that I would come back after college and start this apprenticeship, kind of a long journey to where I'd eventually take over the company. And he'd ride off into the sunset and turn it over to me, and everybody would live happily ever after. But I decided, you know, once my last year of college, so I led a Bible study in the summer at my house. And led a Bible study in my fraternity my last year of college. And I thought, you know, I kind of like this. I think I'd like to get a few more tools to be able to do this better. I had no intention of actually making a living at it. I think my folks considered it sort of like, you know, some college grad, you know, they spend a year traveling in Europe and,
sure,
you know, and they figured he'll do this grad school thing for a year, get it out of his system, come back and, you know, have a real job and, you know, start really contributing. The first year I just thought, I am hooked on this. I still had no idea, you know, that I wanted to make a living, you know, in any kind of local church ministry. I mean, I think the idea of being a pastor, I thought, who does that? I got some tools. Let's go for a second year. I'm not quite done. And then 2 years became three. And then by the end of the third year, I thought, you know, I have just lost interest in going into my dad's business. Thankfully he never once gave me grief about it.
That's great.
And I think he knew that, you know, if my heart wasn't in it, it wasn't going to be good for the business anyway. And then, you know, by the end of the fourth year, I thought, now I got this degree. What on earth am I going to do now? And so I taught Old Testament for, you know, 3 or 4 years at the, this brand new place called the International School of Theology. Bill Bright,
yep,
with Campus Crusade, thought it'd be a great idea to start a seminary.
Yep.
And so he took a chance on a whole, you know, a whole host of us, J.P. Moreland, Klaus Isler, who, you know, who ended up at Talbot later. We're all together here at the start. In fact, the Morelands and I were very close before I was married. You know, we just spent a ton of time together. But basically, as a result of reading the Old Testament, I figured, how can you read the Old Testament well, read the Law and the Prophets, and not be interested in ethics? I just didn't see how you could do that. In fact, I had a provost at another institution ask me, he said, how did you go from Old Testament to ethics? And I looked at him, I said, I just read the text. End of story. And he was kind of taken aback by that, but I explained, you know, you can't read the prophets and not be interested in ethics, in my view. So basically what I wanted to do was do something where I could take my biblical and theological background and apply it to the stuff that was on the front pages of the newspaper. And doing ethics was just the best way I knew of to do that at the time. And when I started doing this, you know, bioethics was just this brand new emerging field.
Yeah.
And all of these wild new ways to procreate children, you know, were less than about 5 or 10 years old at the time. And assisted suicide was just starting to make headlines. You know, all this stuff coming down the pike, and you know, nobody who cared about much about what the Bible said had anything to say. And the people who really did have something to say were the ones who were approaching this from, you know, from a completely secular worldview. And so I wanted to do something that where Christian ethics could be relevant to the culture, but without necessarily having to be totally dependent on citing chapter and verse.
Now, was that a part of the motivation that you and J.P. Moreland kind of co-founded the M.A. philosophy program that I did, hugely formative in my life? In fact, Greg Kokel and I were students at the same time. And did you guys dream this up together? Tell me a little bit, kind of the quick backstory behind starting that program.
Well, we did dream it up together. I think J.P., I think, recognized that he didn't know hardly anything about ethics. And so he had to have a partner, and it just turned out that I happened to be a likely candidate. but we said, you know, what if we started this, you know, this grad program? Because he was, you know, everywhere where we'd go to speak, people would think, you know, where can I go to get more of this? And it was, at the time, there was just no place out there that we could recommend to people who want to study this seriously. And so we thought, well, doggone, if there's nothing out there, why don't we start this? And our dean at the time said, I'll give you 3 years. If you can't make a go of it in 3 years, I'm pulling the plug on.
Wow.
And so we decided, man, we better get to it. And we dreamed up a curriculum. In fact, many of the core classes we still are still using today. And we just kind of started putting the word out. And funny thing happened. People started moving here from all over the country. Wanted to study with us, and we figured, you know, if we get 30 or 40 students, you know, and over our lifetimes, if we send maybe a dozen people on to PhD programs and have, you know, maybe half of those people get teaching positions in state universities, we'd be thrilled. Well, as of today, we've sent over 200 of our grads to PhD programs.
Wow.
We've got probably close to 100 now that are teaching in various secular universities, state university, research university, community colleges. We've got grads teaching at places like the Air Force Academy. We had one of our grads who was teaching as an adjunct at the Pentagon on Christian ethics. We recognized part of our task, the way we put it, the goal was to reclaim lost intellectual real estate in the university. And doing it one faculty position at a time. And it's just gone, you know, we realized we were kind of riding a wave at the time, and God was doing something incredible. We figured, let's jump on and ride this wave and see how far we can take it. And, it, you know, we regularly just pinch ourselves, thinking, how did God take a couple of yahoos like Moreland and me, and make this happen? Most of the time, I'm convinced it was in spite of us and not because of us.
Well, you know, the amazing thing is that roughly half the grads or so you would know better than me become pastors, high school teachers, people in the business field that just apply it in different ways. In fact, your ministry and that program just resonates through everything Stand to Reason does. So God has really used that program in unique ways. Let me ask you one more question. We got about 2 minutes before the break, and then dive into your book. Is kind of the story of the program, the heart behind writing Moral Choices. Why'd you choose to write that in the first place, and what made it unique?
Well, there just weren't a lot of things out there at the time. I mean, you know, the number of evangelicals who were doing Christian ethics at the time, I could probably count on one hand.
Wow. And what's the time, if I could cut in? What are we turning?
This is early to mid-90s.
Okay.
There were a few people who were venturing into this, but it just wasn't near the field that it is today. And I'm not exactly sure why that was, but what I discovered just through my own doctoral study and just the research I had done is that most of the stuff on ethics was either about theory or it was about a practical issue. Hmm. And the folks who were writing on theory, they didn't care one whit about putting shoe leather on. And the folks who were writing about the issues, Lord only knows how they were framing it philosophically and theologically. I mean, there were all sorts of assumptions being made about their approach and how they made ethical decisions and how they looked at virtue and value and moral principles. And I wanted to do something that would bring those two together in a conscious way. And so what we've tried to do all along is to lay a really good theological and philosophical framework for ethics, but then make the majority of the book applying this to the issues that people actually care about and read about in the newspaper. Because I wanted this to be a lot more than just something that would appeal to students and specialists. You know, I wanted this to be something that, a small group in a church could use, pastors would find useful, people who were, teaching in, public high schools could find useful as they're talking about different issues. In fact, we just had one person, one of our recent grads who's teaching here at Woodbridge High School.
Great.
Is just starting a course on ethics and philosophy. It's an elective for seniors at Woodbridge High School, which is where all my kids went. It's super cool to see them using this in these ways. Sean, as you know, I've always had this penchant for putting shoe leather on concepts and ideas. I don't have a lot of tolerance for strictly academic discussion that's scraping the Milky Way and doesn't have much relevance to where people actually live. So that's what I wanted to do with it, but it needed to be framed well and, philosophically serious at the same time.
Well, you've certainly accomplished that, and I think the model is commendable. I've been taking a group of high school students through the Book of Romans, and for a number of the early chapters, it's theology and its background. And then you start getting into chapter 12, he really gets into practice. So biblically, it's theory or theology and its practice, and you've accomplished that. The first few chapters of the book, you talk about relativism, ethical egoism, deontological ethics in a way that's understandable. And then you get into these issues, which we're going to talk after the break. I mean, a range of these issues, sexual ethics, war, violence, and morality, capital punishment, violence and gun control. You really have given us just a great tool with this, and now it's in its fourth edition. Well, we're going to take a break. This is Sean McDowell filling in for Greg Kokel, interviewing Scott Ray, author of Moral Choices and really one of the leading Christian ethicists today. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk more specifically about some of the toughest ethical issues Christians are facing right now.
We are at war. It's not a war of bombs and bayonets. It's not a war against flesh and blood. In fact, it's not a physical war at all. It's a spiritual war. That's why Paul instructs us to put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. The devil's primary scheme is deception. He wants us to believe false ideas about God. And the only way to guard against false ideas is to fill our minds with true ideas. Simply put, we combat deception with truth. It's unfathomable to imagine sending young men and women off to fight a physical war without proper training. Yet, when it comes to spiritual warfare, we do this all the time. The vast majority of our students are simply not prepared for the spiritual battle that awaits them. At this year's Rethink Apologetics student conferences, we're training students to counter the lies of the enemy. Lies like God does not exist, God is anti-gay, Muslims and Christians worship the same God are just a few of the false ideas we'll be addressing. So join me and a number of other speakers at one of this year's Rethink Apologetics student conferences. Find out more information about Rethink by going to rethinkapologetics.com. That's rethinkapologetics.com.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible, and relevant content each week? As a nonprofit ministry, we rely on generous supporters in order to provide the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including apps, blog posts, articles, or short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. When you visit str.org/donate, you'll find a newly renovated transaction page that makes it easier than ever to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources over the past 25 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Please help us to continue on into the next 25 years by making a gift today at str.org/donate.
Welcome back to Stand to Reason Radio. I'm your guest host today, Sean McDowell, filling in for Greg Kokel. And we have on the line today just a dear friend of mine, a colleague at Biola University at Talbot School of Theology, and one of the top Christian ethicists today who's written a wonderful book, now in its fourth edition, Moral Choices. Scott Ray, thanks for coming back on.
Hey, a pleasure. Looking forward to the next segment here.
So you first wrote Moral Choices, I believe, in 1995. Is that correct?
94.
Okay. So you wrote it in 94, came out 94, 95, and then you've updated a number of times, and in 2018 came out with a fourth edition. I'm curious a little bit about how this book has evolved over time and what that tells us about culture. And what I mean by this is my father wrote Evidence Demands Verdict in 1972, updated in the 80s, updated in the 90s. We updated it together about a year and a half ago. And the content we included, the content we took out, tells a bigger story about how culture shifted. So, for example, in the early copies of Evidence Demands Verdict, there was no need to include anything on truth. People assume there's such a thing as truth, and you can know it. But getting into the 2000s, we had to include what is truth, how do you know it? And that's very revealing about how culture has shifted in itself, amongst other things. So how has this book changed through the past, you know, couple decades plus? And what does that tell us about the wider cultural and how it approaches right and wrong?
Well, maybe the better way to think about this is what hasn't changed.
Okay.
Because there's so much that has. But let me give you just a couple of examples. One of the things that I've had to include in the beginning chapters, which I took for granted for a long time, is I finally had to address the notion that people largely today view morality as something that is in the realm of subjective opinion, as opposed to being in the realm of knowledge and facts. And it's sort of a descendant of the fact value distinction that is, you know, it's been in academic circles for a while, but that's finally reached down into the popular world where, you know, if you ask people to distinguish between objective and subjective types of statements, and then include moral statements, and in fact, an exercise that I actually heard from you the first time a few years ago.
Which I got from Greg, just for the record, but keep
okay.
going.
Okay, fair enough. Let's give credit where credit's due.
Right.
You know, the idea that morality would be somehow objective is just a really tough pill for a lot of the people to swallow in the culture.
Hmm.
And even among my seminary students, when I bring up sort of contested moral issues and ask, you know, is the statement that abortion except to save the life of the mother is morally wrong, you know, is that a matter of fact or is that a matter of opinion? And it's about a 50-50 split.
Wow.
Among my seminary students. And so that's an area that I've realized I've had to address that says a lot about how culture view of morality has changed.
Hmm.
The other things that I've had to add new issues, which I think tells us a lot about where culture is headed. You know, for a long time, when I first wrote the book, the idea that I'd have to have a chapter on gun control. Nobody thought much about gun control in the 90s. Maybe it was because I grew up in Texas. you know, maybe that's a possibility. But, you know, the idea that we would have to have a chapter on race and diversity, you know, it's probably a little bit, I probably came to that a little bit later than I should have. You know, and I redid the entire chapter on sexual ethics for the fourth edition because I recognized that really anybody who's writing on sexual ethics after the Obergefell decision that legalized same-sex marriage probably is writing something that's pretty out of date.
And that was just 2015. That was
right.
The year that
right.
happened.
So you know, in sexual ethics, that was a total game changer.
Hmm.
And so I basically started that. I realized I had to start over on that. But the idea that we would have to address, you know, I'd have to write a case about a high school student that has transgender issues. Yeah, you know, I mean, who thought about that in the mid-90s? I mean, nobody thought about that.
I mean, nobody thought about that 5 years ago, really. It just shows the speed of change now that's taken place, let alone the 90s.
So, and you know, I've added a chapter on immigration.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Christians started addressing that, you know, maybe, seriously, maybe 5-6 years ago. You know, but nobody thought about issues around migration in the early to mid-90s. Maybe if you lived in Europe, you did. But there were no issues involved there. So I think some of this new stuff really tells us, it's pretty revealing stuff about where culture is headed and the things that even people in the church are really looking for serious answers to.
Hmm. They always have, but it's even more pressing today. Isn't it? Are there any issues that you took out that were relevant then that are not now? For example, again, in evidence, the JEPD theory documentary hypothesis was huge in, you know, 70s, 80s, maybe into the 90s, but now it's a smaller footnote. So we took a ton of that out. Are there any issues you took out that were bigger in the past that have just kind of faded or been replaced?
Yeah. In the area of genetics and biotechnology, I minimized the section on human cloning, because I think for the most part I've concluded that that's much ado about not very much, and I think in part because the technology to actually do procreative cloning, which is to produce a full newborn from a live birth, has just proven to be really stubborn. There are just some obstacles that science just has not been able to overcome. And so that nobody really talks about that much. I mean, we clone embryos to harvest their stem cells, but even that, that's kind of old news because, you know, most of the real medical action in the use of human stem cells comes from non-embryonic sources.
Hmm.
So that, the whole, you know, the stem cell discussion is, I wouldn't say it's moot, but it's not what it was. The Human Genome Project, the the mapping of the human genetic code, which was a really big deal, genetic privacy and things like that. We've resolved a lot of those things. The Human Genome Project is a dramatically shortened section. I think those are some of the things.
Yeah.
I actually considered taking out the chapter on the death penalty. But since the U.S. is still the, you know, about the only place in the developed world that still has the death penalty, and there are countries in the developing world that are either, more solidifying it or reinstituting it. Like for example, the Philippines has reinstituted it in recent years.
That's right.
So I thought, I probably can't take that one out.
Let me ask you this, not just in terms of issues, but the wider way ethics is viewed. It seems to me that what is somewhat new is that not only do people think Christians are wrong, but our position itself is evil and harming people. So I had about 10 months ago with a well-known kind of internet atheist influencer, and we were on stage, and I said, look, on this issue of same-sex marriage, I think you're wrong. But I think you're motivated by what you think is right, and we got to find ways to work together. I'm not questioning your motivations. I just don't think your arguments and reasons are good. But I don't feel like people extend the same, I didn't use the word grace, but same charity back towards me. And he goes, that's right, because you are stealing people's rights. Your position itself is abominable, essentially being compared to racism.
Yeah, they just say no. They hold that we're bad people for holding these.
Is that newer in your study, kind of a culture and ethics, or has that been there and just not as prominent?
Well, I think on some issues, it's always been there. Like with abortion, I think those of us who stand for the life of the unborn have always been viewed as restricting women's rights over their own body. Now, to be fair, that is what restrictive laws on abortion would do. That is, that does say something about what a woman can do. Now, the idea that the unborn child is actually a part of her body, I think, is a premise that is worth challenging. But we are morally restricting what some of the decisions a woman can make. And I think today, as you mentioned, anybody who doesn't allow anybody to love, have sex with, and sort of become any kind of person that they choose is viewed as being harmful and bigoted. So that, you see that in same-sex marriage, transgender. I mean, anybody who thinks that censorship is not alive and well hadn't been paying attention. Because you try to have the discussion that we had in class about homosexuality or about same-sex marriage or about transgender, we'd be thrown off most of state university campuses in a heartbeat. So I think that the level of intolerance of different views, I think in some of these views has gotten a lot more intense. With stuff related to reproductive rights, I think that's always been the case. It's always been the case that the pro-life movement is viewed as heavily restrictive on women in ways that are deemed to be harmful.
That's fair. Let me ask you this, and then we'll go to break. And then when we come back, I have some specific tough questions for you on particular issues to kind of wrap out the interview. But I'm curious if you could give some comments on how our culture has kind of shifted to what sociologists recently call victimhood culture. There's an honor-shame culture. There's what's called a dignity culture. But now it's as if people are competing to be considered. The greater victim status you have, the more right you have to speak on a number of issues. So we've seen this Jussie Smollett case that's playing itself out in the media right now. And here's an actor who's influential, a black gay man who apparently staged an attack by somebody at, I don't know, 2 or 3 in the morning when it was really cold in Chicago, by somebody wearing a Make America Great hat. And according to one police report, it was that he wanted to make more money. Now, some of those details are being played out, but the idea being, he's already a black gay man, so considered by many to be a victim, but for him to get more status and more money was to actually portray himself as a greater victim. Mm-hmm. Is this something new that's going on in culture? What's the roots of this?
Well, I think in some cases, I think, you know, people who have been historically disadvantaged are feeling empowered to actually say so.
Hmm.
Now, I think there's a good sense of that, but the harmful part is if you just stay there. And, you know, and that's the only conversation we have. And there's no, I wouldn't say there's no virtue in being a victim, in any more than there's virtue in poverty or disadvantage or anything else. But I guess I'd want to be a little bit careful that we don't diminish how difficult it is for people who have been part of historically disadvantaged groups.
Hmm.
Now, I think the long-standing, at least American tradition, and I think one of the things that sets the U.S. apart from the rest of the world is that most people, regardless of where they come from, if they have a modicum of virtue and good health and a modicum of education, are usually able to escape poverty and disadvantage. If you make a handful of choices in the right order, that escaping intractable poverty, I don't think is as challenging as some of these groups make it out to be. But that's the long-standing tradition of our emphasis on freedom and socioeconomic mobility. It's assumed, I think, for most people that you will be better off 10 years from now socioeconomically than you are today if you do a handful of the right things in the right order. Now, I think today, I think that ability to move up the socioeconomic ladder, I think, is increasingly being challenged today.
Hmm.
And I think that, in general, I think is not people who have lost hope of improving their position. I think that's something I think to genuinely be concerned about. Now, the reason they've lost hope could be all over the map, and just because somebody had a poor starting place doesn't necessarily consign them to anything. And so, what I'd be concerned about are the people who use their disadvantage as an excuse to avoid the kind of hard work and education and to make sure that they make the right choices in the right order in order to put themselves in the best position to achieve prosperity, which I think in the U.S. is still the norm. And I think most people, if they're honest, still expect that. I think that's different in other parts of the world.
Sure.
Where there's much more of a caste system, if you will,
yeah,
in other parts of the world that don't have the same sort of tradition that we've had. Basically everybody who came over here initially came over dirt poor and having to make a go of it as best they could. And that tradition, I think, is still deeply rooted. And is something that needs recovering. I do think the culture of victimhood, where it plays out, is a direct challenge to that. And that generally, people who don't believe that they can better themselves through making those choices in the right order and doing the right things, generally, I think that they find that that's harmful for them.
that's a very balanced and fair perspective to see that, especially in America, for many people, there are ways to move beyond some of the pain and hurt and disadvantage in the past, in many, if not most, circumstances. But it's also important to recognize that there is genuine victimhood that's taken place, and people today now have a voice they didn't in the past, and that's something that we as Christians can celebrate. This is Sean McDowell.
Go ahead.
Oh, awesome. We're going to come back right after the break. This is Sean McDowell, standing in for Greg Kokel. We are interviewing my good friend and just ethics extraordinaire, Scott Ray. After the break, we're going to come back, and I'm going to give you some of the toughest questions related to some of the hottest moral issues today, and we'll see how you respond. We'll see you right after the break.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
Sean McDowell today, your guest host, filling in for Greg Kokel, and we are interviewing my good friend and colleague, Scott Ray, one of the top ethicists today, author of an excellent book, Moral Choices. Now, in the first couple segments, we heard a little about your story behind becoming a believer, the story behind the book, the MA Phil program. Last segment, we kind of talked about bigger cultural trends that are changing in the world of ethics. Now, for this last segment, Scott, I just want to throw some tough questions out to you that students have asked me and just give you a chance to kind of give your response to it. So are you ready?
That sounds like the gloves are coming off.
All right, here we go. So last week I was speaking to students and a girl raised her hand and said, is it a sin to be pro-choice?
Not necessarily. I would say it's you are holding a view that's unbiblical if you believe that abortion for birth control reasons is not immoral. Now I think what I would also say is that the law should protect the life of the unborn. And there are reasonable restrictions that can be placed on abortion to protect the life of the unborn, and I think those naturally follow. For example, if you say I'm pro-choice because I don't want government telling me what to do with my body, I'd say, well, why do you think government should protect the rights of women to kill their offspring? I think there are probably some scenarios where a woman's life genuinely is threatened, where like in an ectopic pregnancy, for example.
Sure.
So things like that, I think a woman should have the right to make that choice, to choose her own life, because in almost every case, when the mother's life is threatened, if you lose the mother, you're going to lose the baby also.
Okay, so those exceptions aside, is it a sin for somebody to be pro-choice who believes you can have abortion anytime, anywhere, and it's a moral good?
Yes.
Okay.
That's an unbiblical view.
Fair enough. Good. What about somebody who says, what about bodily autonomy? I mean, we don't force somebody to give blood. and violate their body. So why should we force somebody who's already pregnant to keep the baby?
No, we're not forcing them to keep the baby. We're just not allowing them to kill the baby. Just because I have the right to disassociate myself from any relationship that I don't want to have. But let's say that you and I had a falling out and I choose to dissociate myself from you. But that doesn't follow from that I have the right to throw you off a cliff. You can dissociate yourself from a relationship that you don't want to have without bringing any harm to the person. So we're not forcing people to keep the baby. We're just preventing them from killing their offspring in the womb.
Okay. How about should gay couples be able to adopt?
That's a little harder one. I'd say it depends on what the alternatives are. Because, you know, this is part of, you know, in a fallen world, we're not dealing with ideal scenarios. The reality is we have a lot more kids, especially older kids, that need adoptive homes. And it may be that being adopted by a single mom or a gay couple is better than them bouncing around in foster care or in the public system. Now, is it the best? Clearly not. The best interests of children clearly are served by being raised in a home where the mother and father are married to each other, they're living under the same roof, and they love each other. But if that's not possible, it may be that other options are acceptable, even though they're a long way from being ideal.
So in a sense, we make an accommodation, given the nature of the fallen world we live in, what's best for these kids. Is that a fair summary?
Or what's better than other options.
Okay, gotcha. What's better than other options? Now, I've heard an argument that says, well, for gay couples who are not attracted to the opposite sex and singleness is not a possibility for them, why not make an accommodation for them for same-sex relationships? Because the church does this in other areas, such as you're mentioning in adoption.
With same-sex couples.
Yes.
Adoption is not intrinsically immoral. Adoption is a heroic rescue, regardless of who's doing the rescue. Same-sex sexual relations are intrinsically immoral. So you can't make accommodations to things that are inherently immoral. That's a really big difference.
Fair enough. Just the kinds of philosophical and ethical distinctions I thought you would make. Well, let me keep going. One of the arguments
I'm giving you more Twitter responses, if that's okay.
Oh, no, that's great. That's understood that there's much behind this. Just tools to think about it and unpack it is great, given the time that we have. What about the argument that is, I think, perhaps the most rhetorically and emotionally powerful argument for same-sex marriage and embracing transgender ideology is that it is your theology and mine which believes that people should have their gender identity match their biological sex, and that you should only marry if you get married to somebody of the opposite sex. It's that theology that is killing LGBTQ people. That theology itself is harmful and causing kids to be lonely, depressed, and consider suicide. What are your thoughts ethically when you hear that claim?
Well, I think empirically that's just simply not true. Take for example the transgender phenomenon. All of the best research that's out there suggests that roughly 80% of the kids who have transgender feelings or what I would call transgender temptation as middle school, high school, or college students grow out of that by the time they're in their mid to late 20s. And so with the harm is actually coming from people who encourage that, and especially people who encourage, major surgical changes to a person's body, given that statistic that, people tend to mature out of that. So I actually think it's just the opposite. that's harmful, not our theological views.
Okay. Another one for you. I've kind of noticed a shift where a number of years ago people said, you know, how do we welcome LGBTQ people to kind of how do we address this issue? In other words, from the question of how do we get people to come to church and make sure the church is welcoming to LGBTQ people are coming to our church, how do we address this particular issue? And Glenn Stanton has a recent book that's coming out actually this week, and it's called The Myth of a Dying Church. And he says that people who identify as LGBTQ are 2.5 times as likely to come to a non-affirming church. So this brings a lot of practical questions. And I had a pastor ask me recently, he said, should I dedicate a child of a gay couple? What would you say?
I don't see any reason to punish the child because of the parent.
Hmm.
In fact, I think there is, let's put it this way, the sin that the Bible is concerned about in same-sex relationships is the sexual relationship. There's no reason that a gay person cannot be faithful to Jesus if they abstain from sexual immorality. I'd say I wouldn't recognize the marriage, but you know, a gay couple that has children, I wouldn't necessarily suggest that they have to split up if they come to faith or come to my church. I'm not sure why we would punish the kids for that. But they have to commit to the thing that the Bible is concerned about, which is the sexual relationship. And so I would be very welcoming to people who are wrestling with their sexual identity or their orientation, but have come to several conclusions about it, if they commit to following the same sexual morality that we prescribe for everyone else in the church, which is heterosexual sex in marriage or abstinence and celibacy. And this is where I think that our churches need to have a much more robust view of the what the Bible teaches about singleness, and sort of this expectation of married with children. I don't see that expectation in the Scripture. Paul's very clear in 1 Corinthians 7 about the morality of singleness, and that's in many cases even a more expedient option than being married. So until we get a better handle on singleness just in general, I'd say that's the precondition for our churches being much more welcoming to LGBT folks. Now, if the LGBTQ folks want the church to change their views on marriage and sexuality as a condition for being accepted, you know, then at that point we're going to have to part company and say, you know, you're welcome to attend here, but we can't. You know, we're not changing our views, and we won't sanction a same-sex sexual relationship.
So essentially, to the question of would there be a public dedication of a child of a gay couple is no different than what you would suggest if a couple came together who was living together and had a child. You'd say, okay, let's make sure this relationship is honoring to the Lord moving forward. So you would just have consistency across the board on any child that you dedicate. Is that a quick fair response?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like I said, I don't see That's any great. Reason to punish. I wouldn't punish the child on account of the parents.
Good. Well, let me ask you this one. Almost every time I speak on the topic of LGBTQ conversation, in particular on transgender, somebody always asks about intersex. Does it follow from intersex that sexuality is just, or gender is just, purely a spectrum? Maybe explain what it is and how Christians can think about this.
Yeah, intersex is, I think, a really challenging problem. And I think what makes it so is that parents generally, somebody has to make a decision generally, and usually comes at a fairly young age. So intersex is where a child is born with ambiguous genitalia.
Hmm.
And so generally what happens is that the, parents usually are the ones who make some sort of decision one way or another. And then the necessary surgical things are done in order to make that happen. I think we have to be open to the idea that the parents might not have always made the right choice.
Wow, that's a tough reality to come to grips with.
It is. But I think, usually if that decision is made when the child is very young, I don't know if the parents actually have enough time or enough data to be able to know that they've made the right choice. So intersex, I would take, like all of these things, same-sex attraction, transgender, intersex, all these things, I think are the result of a general entrance to sin. They're not the way God intended for them to be. And what we are called to do is in the midst of wrestling with these conditions that are the result of a general entrance to sin, we still have the obligation to be faithful to Scripture and faithful to Christ at the same time. Just having these conditions does not give us a pass on being biblically consistent in the choices that we make for our sexuality.
Amen. I think that is a great way to think about it, that we have some challenging ethical issues. And you said much of these have come really in the past few years as a result. Really, since you started writing this book in the 1990s, there's been new ethical questions. There's been technological change. And we have to be faithful to Scripture. We can't compromise it. But we have to be thoughtful and loving to people in terms of how we respond. And Scott, that's one of the things I love about how you and really the Bible faculty as a whole, one thing that endears me to it, really does. We want to be faithful to Scripture, but we want to ask, what does it mean to love people today? Scott, Ray, I really appreciate you coming on, and I want to commend your book to our listening audiences, Moral Choices, An Introduction to Ethics by Scott Ray, that's R-A-E, is one of the most important books if you want to think about theory and ethical systems, but also some of the most thorny ethical issues of today. I really hope our readers will get it and listen to it. Scott, thanks so much for coming on. This is Sean McDowell filling in for Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason Radio.